the strategy of siege absolutely encapsulates Assad's approach to Syria, which is you will live under the control of the regime or you won't live at all.
We have a new Holocaust that is called Syria in 2016.
These areas are sealed off. They're surrounded by snipers, by landmines. People can't leave these areas. And when these areas are placed under siege, often there's graffiti daubed or leaflets dropped from the sky. And what they read is surrender or starve, or kneel or starve.
The children of Madaya are eating tree leaves. The children of Madaya are eating cats. They are eating dogs and they are eating insects.
So what, you know, Assad is saying to civilians is, if you do not want to live under my control, I will try and starve you into giving up. And it's no coincidence that a lot of the areas that are under siege are areas that were the kind of beating heart of the Syrian uprising in 2011. So when Syrians ask for freedom, when they ask for democracy, when they ask for those things that you and I, people in Ireland, are lucky to enjoy, their government's response was to place them under siege in the hope that they would acquiesce and live under the rule of the Assad regime.
These are your fellow brothers and sisters. Those are your children. No one wants their children to starve to death.
There's 52 communities in Syria under siege. And the situations in all of them are absolutely terrible and drastic. And what tends to happen is, you know, some areas go up and down a little bit. You know, maybe they get some smuggled aid in, maybe they get a one-off aid delivery. But, you know, at a base level, being under siege means you're cut off from the world. They're a very brutal tactic of war. They're a very cheap tactic of war. And they're effectively a form of collective punishment for a group of people who just asked for freedom and democracy. So they do not have access to food, to medicine, to hygiene, to healthcare, to clean water a lot of the time. And people under siege, you know, they lack essential goods. They could be diapers for kids, dialysis machines, firewood to heat the house. One of the main effects of siege is hunger. You know, so we just spoke to a doctor a couple of weeks ago who was telling me, you know, he had to choose each day which one of his children he could feed. Ordinary life doesn't really exist. You know, schooling doesn't exist, work doesn't exist in the same way. And all of those things create, you know, long-term psychological effects. You know, we hear a lot about people having, you know, mental breakdowns, as you can imagine. And the other area, you know, the other part of siege is that often areas that are under siege are subject to ongoing aerial bombardments. So you have these communities which are sealed in, and then the Assad regime drops barrel bombs, drops missiles onto these communities. So you also have, you know, very high death toll, very high rate of injury, and again, you don't have the medicine or the healthcare in those communities to cope with those sorts of attacks. Official figures around siege that were used by that were created by the UN were wrong. So for the last kind of 3 to 4 years, we had reports of, you know, between 200 and 400,000 people living under siege. And that was a dramatic underestimation of the scale of the problem. And some of that was to do with the classification of siege. So if people remember in the news just after Christmas in January, there was a story that erupted around a small town called Madaya in Syria, where we saw images of starving children. Children literally starving to death in the 21st century.
It's unfair to let them die because Assad decided to block the food from them.
Madaya was not technically classed as a besieged area. So it's just one example of why the classifications that the UN agencies were using to produce the data that goes to international governments, that goes to the United Nations, that methodology was wrong, and that led to a huge underreporting of the problem. So we've partnered with Siege Watch and PACS, who are both two very good kind of policy and and think tanks to look at a different methodology. And, you know, it's now widely acknowledged by governments, by analysts, that there are 1 million people under siege in Syria. You know, there's also incredible resilience from the Syrians who are living under siege. So you have, you know, volunteer rescue workers like the White Helmet saving lives. You have doctors operating in extraordinary circumstances to do what they can to treat patients. You have communities developing solar energy because they can't get fuel for electricity. You have activists setting up underground schools for children to keep them having some semblance of a childhood. We're seeing extraordinary acts of bravery from Syrians in order to maintain some semblance of a life.
The town of grapes and barrel bombs. Daraya is one of Syria's most devastated areas.
And ladies and gentlemen, for the second part of our briefing, we're very pleased to have with us here today John Ging, the Operations Director for the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
If we do not have unrestricted access to move the aid to the people in need, then we are blocked in our humanitarian action. Pieces of paper that purport to be agreements are meaningless. But we need those pieces of papers to start with. That's the significance of having an agreement.
The UN has the authority to deliver aid to every besieged area in Syria, to every child who is without milk. They should be in there delivering aid. They have the mandate under international humanitarian law. They have the mandate under three successive Security Council resolutions to cross conflict lines to deliver aid. They don't need to ask permission from the Assad regime. They should be driving the trucks in there. And Ireland, as a member of the United Nations, can help pressure UN agencies to do more to get aid into the besieged areas of Syria. You know, ultimately it is our tax money which has helped paying for this aid, and we all have a role in making sure that it gets to where it's needed. And right now, UN aid is flowing to areas under regime control, and it's not flowing to people under siege. And what that effectively means is that humanitarian aid is being hijacked by the regime as kind of a further weapon of war. So what we're asking is that to date, the UN has taken an approach of saying, well, we need to ask for permission to get aid in. We need to ask if we can go into these areas. And actually, there's nothing in their mandate or in international humanitarian law that means they need to ask for permission. So what we are pressuring them is to say, Acha, you should be notifying the Assad regime of these areas you're going into, and you should be going in and delivering the aid.
That's the untold story about these sieges.
It's absolutely the untold story. And, you know, there was a similar situation in Syria in 2014 where there was desperate need for humanitarian aid in northern Syria. This was in April 2014. And there was this kind of question, which was the United Nations could drive its aid from in trucks across the border from Turkey and get aid to people in need. And they were having a huge internal debate because they said, well, we can't do that because we can't intrude on the sovereignty of Syrian as a nation state. So we worked with a whole group of international lawyers and international human rights experts who put together a kind of open letter and said, actually, under international humanitarian law, you can't deny humanitarian aid to people in need of assistance. And if you compare those two things, you know, a state sovereignty against kind of international humanitarian law, that should trump. And what we saw is that, you know, the UN then took a bold approach where it said, we're going to deliver the aid, these are the areas we're going to, here's the coordinates, here's the time, let's drive the trucks in. And that aid was delivered. And we would like to see that boldness and approach replicated to cross-line aid, so to getting aid across these kind of lines of conflict to people that need it most. And if they can't do that, and they really think that, you know, we will get shot, you know, the Assad regime will shoot us, or we will be attacked, then they need to get on to the the governments, you know, the UN Security Council members and say that.
Hello, I'm Richard Gisbert and you're at The Listening Post. We're breaking with our usual format this week in order to dig into the media story in Syria.
After the killing of Mary Colvin and Rami Atcha in 2012 in Homs, there was a large-scale withdrawal of Western media. And that's had a huge impact. And the media that we do see from Damascus, you know, those journalists are there with the permission of the Assad regime. So their ability to report independently is greatly, greatly hampered. So while, you know, Syrian journalists and Syrian citizen journalists have done a fantastic job in telling the world what's happening and getting the stories out, the videos, the films, you know, of the crimes, you know, there has been this gap. Source of that brutality is the Assad regime. The violation of human rights, the chaos it has created, has allowed ISIS to grow. It's allowed ISIS to take a foothold. And similarly, it is the brutality of the ISIS regime that has had millions of people fleeing into Europe for safety. That is what the majority of refugees fleeing are fleeing from. So for European governments, when they want to fix the refugee crisis, when they want to, you know, defeat ISIS, all of that starts with ending the brutality in Syria. And all of that starts with dealing with the brutality of the Assad regime.